Well, good afternoon. We have the great pleasure this afternoon of talking to my longtime and good friend, Jen Lewis. Once again, this is the Robert Gard Foundation project to collect stories and history of people who worked with the late Robert Gard, and we all seem to have worked with one another. This is Harv Thompson, and I am the interviewer for our narrator, Jen Lewis. So, Jen, welcome.
No.
And here we are in Lowell Hall. The irony of this particular recording session is Jen and I both worked in Lowell Hall for many, many, many years, and here we are on the 28th of May, 2015, getting back together and recording this interview. So, Jen, welcome. So, why don't we start and go way back, Jen, and let's talk about your parents and their backgrounds and how you became part of their family and so on and so forth. Let's just learn about Jen Lewis.
Okay, well, I came from farm folks, and neither my mother nor my father had more than a grade school education, and they were Catholics and very high morals and standards and ethics, and my father was an excellent carpenter and built houses in Nacoma and Maple Bluff here in Madison. And he was a union man and very Democrat, very much a Democratic situation. And my mother was thrilled to death when she got to see FDR in person. And so my dad was treasurer of the union, so he was very union-oriented. And I was born at St. Mary's Hospital right here in Madison.
Okay.
And I had two brothers and two sisters, all older than I was. I was the baby. I was born when my mother was 42. And none of my family were planned on going to college. And my brother, oldest brother, did go to the seminary when he was only 14, so he got a college education, but my other brothers and sister did not, and so there was no idea maybe that I would go to college, and I was encouraged when I was in high school to take shorthand and typing so I could get a stenographic job when I got out of school, and I ended up when I went to Edgewood high school, and the good nuns at Edgewood were nice enough to give me a scholarship to Edgewood College. Mm. And that was only a two-year school at that time. And so after the first year, I had done well grade-wise, and so they extended my scholarship for another year. And at the end of that, I got an associate degree from Edgewood.
Jen, what year was that?
Pardon?
What years were you at Edgewood College?
I graduated from high school in 43, so that was 44 and 45.
Okay.
And I was always interested in the arts and in singing, what little we had in grade school. And in high school, of course, because of taking the stenographic courses, I didn't have a chance to take any art courses or anything along those lines, and I never did learn to play any kind of instrument, but I did really well on writing and literature classes, and I loved to read. And so when I graduated from Edgewood College, I went to work, and actually as a secretary for an insurance company first, and then for a publishing company. And I got very interested in the whole publishing operation, and I worked with an editor and with the publishing, the printers, and the whole thing. And that's what catapulted me into trying for a journalism degree at the University of Wisconsin, which I eventually got. After that, I worked as a promotion secretary for the Red Feather agencies, and then decided since I had gotten the bicycling bug and had been going on long distance bike trips on my vacations, I decided that I needed to become a teacher so I'd have my my summers free.
Okay.
So then I ended up going back to Edgewood and getting a teaching degree.
Was Edgewood at that time a 4-year campus yet then when you went back for your teaching certification?
Well, I only needed about, I've forgotten how, about not quite 2 semesters, or I guess just two semesters at Edgewood. At that time, the university did not have an elementary education program. And so I went back to Edgewood where they did have one. And when I got out of, when I got my teaching degree, I taught at the Edgewood campus school for 1 year. And then I moved to the public school in Monona Grove, and I was teaching fifth grade. About that time, I met my husband, and we ended up getting married, and I moved to Texas.
To Texas, okay.
So we were down there for a number of years, and then we moved to Hartford, Connecticut. And I only used my teaching in Hartford to do tutoring in the private schools there. And so that was the most use I actually made of the teaching degree.
Jen, in that era, would your teacher's license that you would have obtained in Wisconsin transferred with you? Could you have taught in Texas? Could you have taught in other states?
If I wanted to teach in Texas, I would have had to take a couple of courses, including one in the history of Texas. And so I did a little bit of subbing down there, but I didn't really like that. And so I ended up doing a few little secretarial-type part-time things. But then when I got to Connecticut, there was more opportunity for tutoring, and so then I did use my teaching degree there. And then in 1961, my son was born, and in 1969, my husband died of multiple myeloma. So I had been taking classes at the college where he was a professor in education, special education. And so I almost had a degree in special ed at that point. But we moved back to Wisconsin because most of my relatives were in this area. And so actually, I didn't use my teaching degree in Madison either, except for doing some private tutoring. And then when David got into high school, I decided maybe I should be going back to work. But about that same time, I also got drafted by Clarice Dunn, who was running the Yarns of Yesteryear contest for Professor Gard. And I didn't know him at the time at all, but she did, and he had asked her to do this. So she did it for 1 year, and it just blossomed. I mean, all the older people who wrote their reminiscences were so enthusiastic about it. She got over 200 entries the first year, and they expected it to be a continuing thing, and some of them kept sending in more entries even after the contest was over. And so she recruited me to help her with the contest. And the next year, we did the contest together. And at that time, I met Professor Gard. And
Jen, what year would that be, again, as we're putting this
time frame
roughly?
I think it was 74, maybe.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And so the second year, we did the contest together. And the programs on aging department at Extension was very helpful. Ann Ostrom in that department was very helpful to Clarice and me in getting the contest literature out and all that. Well, then By this time, Professor Garden knew who I was, and the following year, Clarice wanted to bow out, so I took over on the contest and proceeded to run it for quite a few years afterward, like about 10, I think. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of got in the back door at Extension, mm-hmm. because I had a desk in Lowell Hall to run the contest from, and then I kept getting drafted for other projects that Professor Gard had going.
Mm-hmm. Well, your skill set allowed that to happen. Jen, if we went back for a minute to talk about the yarns of yesteryear, what was the purpose? Why was that important in the 70s?
It was a matter of getting first-hand accounts of the first half of the 20th century, because so much happened in those 50 years or 60, 70 years. And the things that happened were totally out of ken as far as current children especially were concerned. They had no idea what life would have been like without electricity, without airplanes, without cars, you know. And so I thought it was very important that all this be put down in writing and firsthand by the people who actually experienced it, so that it would be preserved for future generations.
You've referred to it as a contest. Were there prizes?
There were very minimum prizes, and they were provided by the Wisconsin Regional Writers Association. And, you know, I've forgotten now exactly, but like the first prize was $50, so it wasn't any big deal. And we had a ceremony to give out the prizes at the Wisconsin Regional Writers annual meeting. And so it gave those people a little prestige to be awarded their prizes. And we gave a lot of honorable mentions, too. And the second year, I think it was, we already were getting like 500 entries. And for the next 10 years, we got anywhere between 500 and 700 entries every year. And so people were just really sitting out there saying, we thought you'd never ask us about this. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of enthusiasm for the contest.
And you mentioned the Regional Writers Organization. That was another program that Bob Gard had founded
I believe so.
And nurtured all the way along. And I'm sure a project like the one you're describing would have been important to that organization as well. It was another moment in time where Wisconsin people were writing their stories, telling their stories.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. So it was, that was sort of the way I backed into the department, and then I started getting called on to do other projects with Professor Gard and started working with him on the Rhinelander School of the Arts. And so that was sort of the other big project that I got involved in with him. There were several other things that we did. We worked with the Folklore Society. We did something with them, tried to get more interest in it, and we had one meeting up in Eau Claire for a couple of days that went pretty well, but there wasn't anybody there who really wanted to take it over, and so it didn't progress beyond that. And then we also, Professor Gard also gave a class at Stoughton in writing reminiscences, and out of that a book called Blossoms, I think. That particular thing I went with Professor Gard when he was giving the classes, and also was very instrumental in getting the book published for the Stoughton Senior Center group.
Jen, if we went back just one step on the reminiscence writing, did not a independent study course eventually develop through you and Bob for reminiscence writing that people could actually enroll in a writing class, and then they would get your responses back through the mail?
Yes. We did set up a correspondence course. Mm-hmm. Clarice wrote the manual, and we used the Yarns of Yesteryear book, which was called We Were Children Then. Actually, we published two books of contest entries called We Were Children Then. And one of the books was used as the
So, Jen, we took a short break there just to kind of catch our breath. We were in the middle of talking about the correspondence course, which was a very successful program for senior writers that you and Clarice Dunn and Bob Gard's oversight made happen. Tell us more about that.
Well, I had sent out a national press release telling that we had this course available, and we got quite a good response. And, in fact, the response was so great that it actually brought in quite a bit of money for the department, and which was a very good thing, of course.
Yes, always helpful.
But we had people from all over the country, and we would send out the book and the first lesson, and then when that lesson was returned, then the second lesson would be sent out, etc. I think there were 10 lessons. And so it was got people all over the country writing their reminiscences, which was, I thought, a very good thing.
Mm-hmm. And Jen, were you?
Clarice also gave workshops in Wisconsin at various senior centers or writers groups or whatever on reminiscence writing. So that was another, that was strictly volunteer, so there was no money involved in that particular project.
And yet you had created a textbook with the We Were Children Then to use as a companion piece to the class, right? You said that each person...
Well, we just sent one lesson at a time.
Right.
Yeah.
But did they
put
also purchase the We Were Children Then book?
Yeah, they got the book as a part of the correspondence course.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And there were always references in the lessons to stories in the book as examples of what they were, you know, trying to... what was being taught.
My thinking is that might have been fairly new in the 1970s, 1980s to teach writing, reminiscence writing via the mail.
It probably was. I don't really know.
Yes, yes. Now, I was going to ask about instructors. Were you and Clarice the only people, or did you have to hire other people to teach and grade?
Clarice did most of the critiquing, and I only did a little bit of it.
But it sounds as if maybe hundreds of people enrolled over time?
I think there were several hundred, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Fascinating. And so the course itself was called Reminiscence Writing?
Yes.
Okay. Didn't you and Clarice also offer that course at School of the Arts in Rhinelander? Was that one of the courses?
Yes, Clarice taught the course at Rhinelander. I guess I taught it 1 year, and she taught it most years in reminiscence writing.
Mm-hmm.
And we had quite a good number of people who registered for that class up there.
So you really created a great enthusiasm among Wisconsin writer people who maybe didn't even know they were writers,
right?
But they had a story to tell, and you encouraged them to write it down.
Right. Yeah. So now I just hope that they can be, all those entries, which mounted up to thousands, can be preserved in the archives.
Mm-hmm. Jen, can you talk a little bit more about how the book, Books We Were Children Then, came about? Was that a goal at the beginning, or was it because you had these wonderful stories that needed to be published?
Well, we had all these wonderful stories, and they Stanton and Lee, Mark, what was his name?
Mark LaFave.
Mark LaFave, mm-hmm, was a friend of Professor Gard's, and he was very interested in the stories, and he was the one who sort of helped promote the idea that we should print these. And so Stanton and Lee actually printed both books.
Okay.
And technically there were supposed to be, I think, 5 books.
Oh.
But only 2 of them got printed, and Stanton and Lee was bought up by somebody else or something, so that the continuing publication was interrupted at that point.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jen, what fascinates me is, as you said, you kind of backed into this because of your friendship with Clarice Dunn, and yet as she transitioned away from the university, you were fully prepared to walk in and continue the work and stabilize it and expand it. And what do you think in your background prepared you to do that? Everything you've described so far, or anything special?
Well, I don't know. If I got my teeth into something, I always wanted to make it go. Mm-hmm. And so I think that was sort of part of it. And I just found it fascinating to get into all this reminiscence writing and see how enthusiastic all these people were about getting their stories out. And also, I'd always been interested in the arts, and so the Rhinelander School of the Arts was, you know, just a great idea, I thought. And so I wanted that to really go also. And so I was very anxious to work with that, with Professor Gard. And so that's how I sort of got backed into these other projects after I once got a desk at the extension office. I sort of oozed into all these other projects. And Professor Gard seemed to think that I could do it.
Mm-hmm. What qualities did he have, Jen, that kind of encouraged people?
I think he was a really great idea man for how to involve people in the community in arts. And he did it a very low-key way. He would propose some idea to somebody that he knew was interested in this kind of project, and then he would just turn it over to them. And he never micromanaged things, but he just encouraged people to take on these projects, and then they would take them off. They'd run with them. And so I think that was really one of his major attributes, that he had this innate ability to inspire people in a very low-key way into doing all these things in community arts that they wouldn't have done otherwise.
Can you think of a couple of examples or a couple of unique stories that maybe no one would know about except you observing Bob or
Well, I can't.
Work?
I mean, the yarns contest is one very big one as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure the Rhinelander School of Arts, which started long before I was involved, was the same kind of idea, that he worked with the arts board up in Rhinelander and got them enthused about the idea, and the school superintendent got enthused about the idea, and you know, and people just kind of picked it up and ran with it. And I think that was his innate ability to inspire people to do all kinds of things, especially in the arts.
I think the School of the Arts in Rhinelander became a kind of a leading role model for the Wisconsin idea of taking the university to the boundaries of the state, and certainly going into a community and helping it establish its centering on the arts by helping organize an arts council and creating a school. In the early years, the school was 2 years in length, 2 weeks in length, excuse me. I'm not sure when you started working with it, if it was still the two or if it had
collapsed. No, it was just the 1 week by the time I started working with it.
And I think, and now it's down to a weekend, so I think it has had to transition itself to people's available time.
Well, I think part of the thing now is with the internet, there's so many things you can, classes you can get on the internet in various arts and writing especially, and, you know, that people aren't so dependent on going somewhere to learn, even though I always thought the Rhinelander experience was more than just the classes. It was the interaction with all the people that were there and with the artists in residence that were brought in, and there was more to it than just something off the internet. But I think that's probably why it sort of dwindled in interest, maybe.
Mm-hmm. You would, excuse me, just mentioned that there were artists in residence or writers in residence, and at one point in time, that seemed to be a major attraction for people from throughout the state and the region, really, to come to the School of Arts location.
Right.
Do you think that that was the major attraction, or were there other reasons that people would give up a week of their time and come to Rhinelander to study?
Well, I think it was partly just the meeting other people with similar interests. And I think the artist in residence idea sort of dwindled in importance over time, so that people didn't so much come for the artist in residence, but just for the classes and for meeting people of similar interests. And of course, there were always new and different things being offered at Rhinelander, so that was an attractive thing too.
Another observation of School of the Arts is that it was a location where, in fact, all of the arts took place at the same time. So someone interested in dance and movement perhaps could take a writing class or a painting class or a theater class.
Right.
And all of the others commingling that way as well. Did you experience a lot of overlap from people that they didn't come just for writing, but over the years they were willing to put their toes in another arts discipline as well?
Yes, I think that was true. I don't remember a specific incident, but I know from talking to people that they did dabble a little bit sometimes in something else. Maybe they'd take one music class.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and expand their horizons a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was a very useful thing too with Rhinelander.
The used book sale comes to mind as almost a feature of the program. Can you explain how that operated or who managed that?
Well, that's still going on apparently from the current brochure I read, and it seemed to be something that just fit in, you know, very well with the whole atmosphere there. And people really enjoyed browsing around through all the books that were available. And it was a way, again, of connecting the community to the Rhinelander School of the Arts more, because this was a local group, women's group, that were running the book fair.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of inter-community relationships there.
I think the American Association of University Women.
Yes, I think they were
the
ones
sponsors
who did the
of
books.
That. And then I think there was a period of time that teaching faculty, staff, and students as well could bring their books that they had published that were available for sale as well. So
that's right.
It really continued to enhance the field of writing. when you, I think there were a period of years where you were almost Bob's administrator representative to the school, and other people. I know Cedric Vig, who's deceased, but was the superintendent of schools for a number of years. Dorothy Gilday.
Right. Those two were sort of our contacts in Rhinelander who helped smooth things out there and arrange about the school availability and any other things we needed to do locally. And so they were extremely helpful. Mm-hmm. And there were a couple years when the administrator for Rhinelander was somebody who lived up in Shell Lake, and of course he wasn't very directly involved with Rhinelander at all, so we depended a lot, I depended a lot on Sid and Dorothy at that point. And actually I was what technically I suppose might have been called an administrative assistant or something like that through the course of three different directors. And so it started out with Professor Gard and then went to this gentleman in Shell Lake and finally to my very good friend who was sitting across the table from me, Harv Thompson. And so in a way I almost felt sometimes like I knew more about school of arts than they did.
Indeed, Jen, indeed.
But maybe that was egotistical on my part.
Well, and I was going to put a time frame in here for our listeners because Bob retired from the university in 1980. So prior to 1980, you're working with Bob on the School of Arts or any project would have been with him as a working professor here. And then upon his retirement, Daryl Aderman, I think is the
name.
That we would add in here, Professor Aderman, who was with the Eau Claire campus at that time and operating the Shell Lake program and also oversaw the School of the Arts. And then in 1985 is when I became the chair of our department here and thus the director of School of the Arts to kind of move it into its next life, if you will. So it's fascinating to hear you kind of talk about the range of maybe a decade there.
Right.
And your own retirement from the university was in what year, Jen?
Oh, boy.
In the 90s?
I think so.
The early 90s, perhaps. Because I think you and I worked together for a good half dozen years, perhaps.
Something like that,
Before your retirement. So. And, of course, that was a great time for all of us to go to Rhinelander every summer. And Jen, if we go back, unless maybe you have something you wanted to add in
We're doing fine.
I'm just, something that I wanted to visit with you is going back to your undergraduate years at Edgewood College and kind of education for young women at that time. And I think you alluded to the fact that basically you were guided to train for stenography and for secretarial work.
Right.
Were there teachers, were there people around you at that time in the educational process that encouraged you to do something different from that? Was there anybody who stands out?
Anybody specifically did, you know, suggest that I should go on to the university or anything along those lines. I think in those days, really, you were still in the mode where women became teachers or they became stenographers or secretaries, and they didn't aspire to much beyond that. And so I think that's sort of the way it was in those days. And so I didn't really, after finishing the 2 years, it was strictly liberal arts kind of courses that I was taking.
Okay.
I didn't think it prepared me for anything else. at that point, because there was no specialization like journalism or, you know, something different.
And yet you mentioned you were very interested in books.
Yes, I had always been interested in books from the time I was a child. In fact, the library in Wisconsin, the Madison Library, was right up around the corner from Holy Redeemer Grade School. And another friend and I used to go up to the library after school frequently and spend a lot of time there. And so I had always been very interested in reading and read a lot of books. And always did well in writing classes also. And so that was probably what kind of pushed me into journalism too.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, as you were growing up, there really wasn't any external influence, be at home or school or anywhere in your day-to-day life, that said, Jen, get educated, get more education.
No.
That was self-propelled.
Yeah, that was pretty much self-propelled. Nobody, you know, in our family had gone to college, except for my brother who went to seminary, of course, and so there was no push from the family end for me to increase my education.
I think you had mentioned scholarships from Edgewood High School to go to Edgewood College.
Right. Otherwise, I don't think I would have gone to college.
Okay.
I think, so I have to say thanks to the nuns at Edgewood that they gave me that scholarship, because that really propelled me on my way.
So in its own way, maybe they were silently encouraging you or identifying you.
Right.
That you could do more, and that they...
Yeah, I think so.
They saw this potential in you that all these years later, indeed, you put all of those skills to work. When you came back to Madison, how did you re-enter the city, or how were you involved in education in any way? Were you
the only
volunteer?
Thing I did was some private tutoring. Mm-hmm. And... other than that, I didn't. My son was ADD and had some visual problems. And so I was very much involved with training programs with him. And so I didn't get involved with any other educational, you know, things. So... I waited until he was in high school before I even thought about trying to get a, you know, any other job.
You've mentioned Clarice Dunn, and just revisiting Clarice, who had so much energy, as I recall, and had many ideas, and a great support system to Bob Gard, that I'm sure. How did you and Clarice get acquainted? How did you know one another?
It was when I was in journalism school, and I was active at St. Paul's University Chapel, and Clarice was working on her master's at that point, I believe, and so we got acquainted at the chapel and became very fast friends, and so that was how I got involved then with the Yarns Project. And the whole thing just kept snowballing.
So as she got to know you, it was very clear to her, this woman should be involved in the University Extension's Yarns of Yesteryear program.
Yeah.
When you first started, I'm trying to clarify this in my mind, were you reading the stories? Is that what Clarice had you do, is to... help judge the stories, help...
No, I didn't judge the stories at all. We had several judges. The first year, there were just three judges, I think. And one of them was Jill Dean, who was, you know, Wisconsin Trails editor.
Okay, Jill Dean.
And another one was Custer, who was did a lot of historical research for Madison, and I've forgotten who the third one was. But anyway, that was the first year. But then when it got to be so many entries in later years, I would have five judges and parcel out the entries to them, and they would each pick the 10 best from their group. And then the five judges would get together, and all five of them would read everybody else's 10 best. And then that's how we ended up finding the winners and the honorable mentions and so forth.
As that program was developing, was there ever a theme that developed each year, that this year they talked about toys, or this year they talked about games outside the school building or anything, or was it?
No, it was
just
very
everything.
General. The brochure that I put out every year would list a number of possibilities, like you mentioned, you know, did you ever get a ride in a flivver? Did you, you know, have a special toy that you especially loved, or what did you do after school, or, you know, just general questions that would kind of make them think about their childhood and young adulthood, and what went on, you know, what was their first brush with electricity, or did they ever get in an airplane, or, you know, just general questions. I usually had a whole list of them on each brochure that to try and just jog their memory a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And I would imagine working with the Department on Aging or aging programs, we're talking about the 70s and the 80s, I think.
Yeah.
That these possibilities for people to record their stories was very important and very new and very rewarding.
Right.
To the authors. I wanted to also go back, Jen, mentioning that the prize might have been $50 or less, and yet I'll bet the honorable mentions were just as important, if not more important, than an actual prize.
I think so. You know, they were just so delighted to be recognized that something they wrote got some kind of recognition. So that's why we had like 20 honorable mentions at least.
So in recapping some of the things that specifically happened is that there was a contest, which really was the beginning point, that as people learned, oh, I can write my childhood story and send it in. But then developing from that were courses, classes that
right.
that Clarice created, and you also were capable of teaching. And then there was also the publication of some of the stories, and We Were Children Then.
Right.
And so it just seems to me that you really, with Bob's guidance and with Clarice, found something that really was going to make a difference in people's lives.
Right.
And it did. And I was going to check. I don't know if perhaps the course is still available, if the Department of Continuing Studies...
The Department has gone through so many changes that I really thought from the beginning that the real name should have been kept the same.
Well, why don't we just take a short break, and then we'll catch up and we'll come back again with Jen Lewis on the 28th of May, 2015. Well, this is Harv Thompson continuing our conversation with Jen Lewis. And one of the things, Jen, that we talked about during our break was going back to School of the Arts and exploring together just a little bit of how that program involved the community at large and involved people from the greater Rhinelander area as well as the people enrolled in the program. So maybe you could just explore that with us. What types of things made it allowed it to be also important to the citizens of Rhinelander?
Well, we also always had noon lectures done by the artist in residence, and that was open to the public, anybody who wanted to come from the community. And in the evening, there was one evening when we had little mini classes of various classes that were offered during the week that the public was invited to if they wanted to kind of explore one little area or go to several little mini classes to find out what was going on at the Rhinelander School of the Arts. And maybe the next year they'd come back for a full class. And sometimes we also had an evening lecture that was open to the public. One of the people on the staff would discuss their specialty. And so we tried to involve the local people as much as possible. And the Northern Arts Council, which was the arts council in Rhinelander, was very much involved with the School of Arts. And they had a big lecture and awarding of the prizes for their art contest during the week of Rhinelander, and all the people from the School of the Arts were invited to attend that. And so in as many ways as possible, you know, we sort of tried to integrate the School of Arts with the local community so that they were really a part of the whole program.
Again, part of the Wisconsin idea of
going into a community. Absolutely. I always felt that Rhinelander was just the epitome of Wisconsin idea. So I was very upset when there was a possibility that it was to be junked.
Very, very strong moment to take pause of everything around us, I guess, Jen. We were talking during our break about another interesting thing which makes you the model of what people do when they retire as far as School of the Arts goes. And why don't you tell us what you started doing after you retired
from
the university?
Well, as soon as I retired, I started being a student at Rhinelander because I was so interested in all the art courses that I hadn't been able to take a course while I was in an administrative position. So every year I'd go back to Rhinelander for 5-6 years and take art courses. And I think I took just about every one that they offered. And I remember the drawing class especially. I had never been particularly good at drawing. And when the professor or the teacher asked for our backgrounds, I said, I draw stick figures. But by the end of that class, he was such a good instructor that I was actually able to do the head of the live model we had, and it actually looked a little bit like him, which I thought was a big accomplishment. And so I took all kinds of other classes, too, along those lines, and I'm still very interested in all kinds of art things and work with the RSVP, doing sewing projects for them. And most recently we've been asked to do panels with textured materials for Alzheimer patients who seem to like to rub their fingers over various textures. And I can't just make a big blob of this fabric and that and the other. So I try and make my panels pictures. So I had a corduroy house and a felt sun and some flowers with slippery stems of green material and frilly flowers that could be felt. And the people at the Alzheimer's Association call them fidgety fingers panels. And so I've been doing a few of those, and it's been really interesting to work with all the different textures. And at the house, the apartment where I live, it's for seniors, and so I've tried to get people involved with projects there, and I actually had an exercise tape that I wasn't doing very well using on my own. So I suggested we put it on the machine down in the community room so everybody could get started on exercise. So that particular tape was shown then, and then the management bought two more tapes. So we now have three exercise classes going every week. And so I also got started a group playing Scrabble, and a lot of other game things have gotten started also now. So I'm still trying to do my little bit for the good of everybody.
Well, that's great, Jen. And what's really interesting is, as we've been talking, one of your main areas of expertise was developing senior writing and working with seniors. And now, like the rest of us, we have evolved into being those seniors. But in your case, you haven't given up helping organize and helping structure something so that seniors can continue to
right.
enjoy being children sometimes.
Right,
being,
yeah.
Being something other than the age we might be. Well, Jen, this has been a great conversation. Is there anything else from the notes that you made or anything that we've talked about that you might want to be sure we add into this interview for people?
No, I don't think so.
We have mentioned a number of names that people who have been listening would perhaps find them. Clarice Dunn, I would repeat that name, was kind of your colleague who brought you into the senior writing
right.
program. And the project was Yarns of Yesteryear, so that was the great program that got people writing about their childhood. And out of that came a contest, out of that came two anthologies, out of that came an independent writing course. So that, like so many things in Extension, one great idea will
blossom.
Spring many other things and indeed will blossom. And of course that's what Bob Gard did for so many of us during his career, Jen. So we are at the end of time. Is there any, as we're signing off, a story that comes to mind or some activity that someone wrote about all these decades ago that when you were reading it has stayed with you all this time?
Well, let's see. I'm trying to think. I can't really think of any specific one. You know, so much of that I was just sort of on the edge of.
Okay.
And I had so many families that were still on the farm. So a lot of what was written by people who had grown up on farms.
Okay.
And I had had personal experience with a lot of that myself, even though I always lived in the city. Mm-hmm. And so the only one that kind of sticks in my mind was the person who wrote about the first time they had electricity in their house. And they were so excited about it, they ran all over the house, turning on all the lights, and then they didn't know how to turn them off. And so that one really struck my funny bone, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And anyone listening to the tape now or forward will find that almost impossible, and yet the discovery of all these new things that your clients at that time lived through. Very fascinating, Jen. Do you have something from your childhood that if you were sitting down now to write your yarn of yesteryear, that you might pick as your topic for that story from your very own childhood?
Well, not really. The only thing I remember in our household that was really retro, you might say, was that we had a pump on the kitchen sink that pumped rainwater from a cistern outside. And whenever we washed our hair, we always use the rainwater.
Wonderful story and many stories, Jen. And we have been talking with Jen Lewis, and this is an interview as part of the project with the Robert E. Card Wisconsin Idea Foundation. And this project is also co-sponsored by the UW-Madison Oral History Project and also the Wisconsin Arts Board. This is Harv Thompson, who's had a great time visiting with longtime colleague and friend Jen Lewis. So thank you, Jen. This is Harv Thompson back again with one final note from Jen. And what I'm wondering, Jen, is how would you like to be remembered by those with whom you worked and the hundreds of people you influenced?
Well, I think I'll quote Pogo, and excusing the grammar, I'd like everybody to remember that I did my pitiful best.
And that was Jen Lewis.